Well, hello and welcome back to the final episode of our series on the Anglican Book of Common Prayer. I am back with Trip Gordon this morning. And Trip, as I am looking at our notes for this upcoming podcast, there are a lot of dates and a lot of names. And so before we start what looks like a thorough overview of English and American history, I wanted to start with something that is totally unrelated. Trip, when you were a child, you had a favorite animal.
I think so.
Okay. You're not confident that you had a favorite animal?
I mean, yeah. I think it's always been the same. I like dogs.
Your favorite animal is a dog.
I know. It's bad.
It's not bad. It's just boring.
Yeah, I know.
That's okay.
I'm trying to think. I never had like a favorite, like, I'm like a tiger kid or like a lion kid or something like that.
Really? You know? That's surprising. So. I would have always thought you'd be like a gorilla guy or something.
Yeah.
How about
yeah.
dinosaurs? Do you like dinosaurs?
Yeah, I mean, when I was really young.
I think every little boy likes dinosaurs and trucks.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is about us.
It's funny. Like, some of my friends, their kids are getting old enough to, like, they've memorized dinosaur names and stuff. I'm like, oh, man, like, I forgot about these things.
it's part of coming as age.
Yeah.
Coming of age as a boy in America specifically.
Yeah.
Is you have to know about trucks and dinosaurs. It's really important.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, that doesn't make for a very good conversation if your favorite animal is a dog. But my favorite animal was a turtle.
Okay.
And I always like to remember, it's not my favorite animal anymore, which is not important, but one of my favorite stories ever was I was asked by a teacher what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I said I wanted to be a turtle. So to this day, whenever somebody asks me, oh, like, what did you want to be when you grew up? I always say, oh, I wanted to be a turtle. That's all. That's all non sequitur. I just wanted to talk about something other than English and American dates and times.
Good. Dogs are great. I've always loved dogs.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Did you grow up with a dog?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought so. Okay. But let's jump in because I know there's a lot we got to do today. You wanted to preface all of our dates and times. Do we need to memorize all of this stuff?
No. Well, I guess the preface is just simply, okay, this is the closing episode. What we're trying to do in this episode is a pretty big task, and that's to take things from really 1662 prayer book to 2024.
Oh, cool. 400 years of history. We'll be fine.
And within that, we're trying to take, you know, just changes, historical changes, theological changes, and help people understand. You know, the approach here is not to give you, like, you don't need to make a Quizlet, you know, flashcards about all this stuff. People do that for seminary and ordination, and trust me, I've had to do that. But I think what we're trying to answer here is actually a super important question. There's a lot of questions around what is Anglican identity? What is the identity of the Anglican Church in North America?
Uh-huh.
And to answer that question, you have to have some sort of grasp on the prayer book and how it evolved over time. If you can't answer that, you can't really answer that other question of what it means to be Anglican in the 21st century. So I think this is a pretty important podcast.
Great.
And also, again, we're working on territory here that there's disagreements, I just want to say.
Okay.
And so I am presenting an approach that I think is a helpful and accurate approach, but there are other voices even within the Anglican world that would hear this and nuance it further. So I just want to say that. So
okay.
As we're like working through dates and stuff, you may get bogged down on names and stuff. It's not important that you necessarily remember all of them. I think what is important is the general trajectory. And then by the time we get to the 2019 prayer book, how it understands, how its own self-understanding, if you will. And so how we move forward with the 2019 prayer book.
Okay, great. I have one question before we start. Because I have one area of extreme interest in this, which is I am deeply confused about how we went from Anglican and then there was Episcopal, and now we're Anglican again.
Right.
So that is a sandwich I don't understand. Are you going to explain that?
Absolutely.
Very excited. Yeah. Okay, please continue.
Yeah. So where to begin? Okay. Well, what do people, when they think of the Anglican Church's beginnings, who do they normally think of?
They think of a king who really wanted to marry a bunch of women.
Yes.
no, wait. He really wanted to have a son.
Right.
And the women
ended up marrying a bunch of women.
Yes. okay, that's what I think of.
Yeah,
so yes, Charles.
Henry.
No, Henry. Sorry.
One of those English names.
Henry.
You just guessed John, Richard, Henry. You'll get to one of them.
Yeah.
So, yes, Henry VIII, a lot of Henrys, so was married to Catherine of Aragon, very close to a Lord of the Rings name, but not exactly. Well, Catherine could not bring him an heir. She did give birth, but the children didn't survive.
Oh.
And so, naturally, in the 16th century, and we'll talk about this in the interview with Ashley Noel, like, you think you're cursed, right? Mm. And so, Henry ultimately gets his marriage annulled with Catherine to marry Anne Boleyn. That's key phrasing there. A lot of people think it's divorce, and actually, it was an annulment. Henry requested an annulment from the Pope. It was not granted, and that's when the separation happened. All right, okay. You're looking with curious what eyes.
Okay, so an annulment is not a divorce? I don't want to get bogged down here too long, but what's the difference?
It's essentially an annulment is saying the original marriage was never legitimate in the first place. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Weird.
Weird, for sure. And so he marries Anne Boleyn, declares himself head of the church. That is 1529. So if you're keeping dates at home, that's 12 years after Martin Luther's whole thing happens in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Cranmer is made archbishop in 1532. Henry dies 15 years later in 1547. I think it's something helpful to remember about Henry, something we've talked about a little bit before in this podcast, is Henry was still by and large Catholic. He was not a fan of Martin Luther. He was not a fan of the Continental Reformation. And so he's still largely and sacramentally Catholic. When he calls himself the defender of the church, he's taking that title from Rome and saying that for himself, you know. So anyways, Henry's not Protestant. Henry's not Protestant. So Cranmer has to kind of like slowly weave in some of his Protestantism, which he largely got from Germany as he came back to the British Isles. He had difficulty kind of forming in his Protestant convictions until Henry dies. And then his son Edward takes the throne. Edward's a boy king. He's very young. So Cranmer has a lot of leeway to develop in some of his stuff. Some of these things we talked about before, 1549 is Cranmer's first prayer book, kind of an initial start on what a Protestant liturgy looks like in England. By 1552, he has a full-fledged Protestant prayer book.
Which is the one we've been talking about.
Yes. Okay. Well, lo and behold, 1553, Edward dies.
Okay.
But England is still a hodgepodge of all sorts of things. And you've got people who love the Protestant movements. You've got people who just 10 years ago were Catholic, you know? And so, like, they want to be Catholic again. And the heir to the throne was Mary, who was a Catholic, Mary I, otherwise known as Bloody Mary.
Oh, yeah, a positive name.
Mary only reigns from 53 to 58. And, you know, relatively, Elizabeth's going to be queen right after her. Elizabeth kills a lot more people than Mary, but I think Mary kills so many people in such a short amount of time, and it's told from a Protestant perspective that she gets labeled as Bloody Mary.
Mm.
In that, though, obviously, all the liturgies go out the window.
Sure.
And Cranmer is killed, and many of the other English reformers. So that's not fun. Cranmer's killed. It looks like the Reformation is not going to last in England. Well, lo and behold, Mary dies in 1558.
Great.
And so who's up? It's Elizabeth the First. Many people know Elizabeth the Second, the queen for most of our lives.
Yes.
The first Elizabeth was in the 16th century, and she reigns for about 50 years. She reigns for a while.
Oh, my gosh. Man, Elizabeths do very well on the English throne.
So 58, Mary dies, just catching us up to speed. By 59, we have a new prayer book. So the prayer book is revised under this kind of, this is where the language of the Via Media comes from, kind of a middle way.
Okay.
Elizabeth a little bit is like, hey, this country is going crazy. We need to just chill out a little bit before we keep killing each other. And under Elizabeth, there's this kind of middle way between the Protestantism of what we saw in the early 50s and the Catholicism, but it's still Cranmerian.
Okay.
That's the prayer book that it's working with largely, but some of the language has changed to welcome in some of the more Catholic leaning. So, going to fast forward real quick. Did you have any questions real quick there?
I'm just trying to build a little timeline here. So, we start with Cranmer, who starts a little bit more. He's like a Catholic Protestant mix, and then he comes out of his shell. 52, maybe don't use those words, but by 1552 we are fully Protestant, we are fully Reformed, and then we change monarchs a couple of times. Cranmer dies, and now we're back to like the 50-50 split.
Yes.
Okay.
With like some more Catholic sympathies.
Okay. Great.
Elizabeth reigns for 50 years, very stable throne. And then you've got a few other kings at the beginning of the 17th century. One of them you may be very familiar with, a guy named the King James.
Does he have a Bible?
He does. He has a Bible. You've got James, you've got Charles, and Charles is really important because Charles's throne leads into the English Civil War. Now, okay. This is not a podcast where we need to get into the English Civil War too much, but that's in 1642. From 1642 to 1651 is the English Civil War. During that time, the Book of Common Prayer is abolished. Dun, dun, dun.
Okay, wait. I was not expecting that.
That's when you have the Commonwealth, Oliver Cromwell and everything, and then you've got a Presbyterian kind of reign in England during that time. That's where you have the Westminster Confession and all sorts of things like that.
Okay.
Lo and behold, Civil War ends, and there's a restoration of the monarchy. After that, then you have the 1662 prayer book, which is largely what we've been talking about in our discussions here. The prayer book is revised again, and it has been the standard prayer book ever since in the Anglican world. So a lot of dates and times there, Jake, and listener, thanks for bearing with me. But what I want you to hear and see during that is this back and forth tension within the Anglican tradition between Catholic and Protestant. And that doesn't, of course, end in 1662.
Sure.
But you kind of have to understand the course of this history to understand the prayer book we receive in 1662 and what's going to come after this. So when you read in the most recent Anglican Catechism, you'll read something that says the 1662 prayer book is predominantly composed of scriptures formulated into prayer, and it has been the standard for Anglican doctrine, discipline, and worship for subsequent revisions and languages. So if there's any source material, kind of standard source material for the prayer book all around the world, if you go to South Africa and say, hey, what is your prayer book like? It's not, sure, they're not going to pick up the 1662 prayer book, but what they will do is they'll say, we've taken this 1662 prayer book in line with Article 34, with, if you remember, Article 34 is about not all liturgies need to be exactly the same.
Sure, it's about
due to
keep
diverse
current
times and places, yeah, you know. But they've taken 62 and they've adapted it for that time and place.
Okay.
So and so on and so forth all around the world. Though, Jake, some things have changed from 1662 till now. What, in your mind, is probably the biggest thing in this continent that happened between 1662 and today?
If I had to guess, it has something to do with us deciding we didn't want to be English anymore.
Yes. So some people threw some tea in the Boston Harbor, and we were off to the races.
Yes.
You know?
And we decided we didn't want a king, and off we went.
Yeah, so American Revolution happens, of course. And that's, so you asked originally why we're not called Anglican.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, if you said you were Anglican in 1780 or 1770, whenever.
Sure.
You were essentially, it's like saying you're a communist in 1948.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense now that you say it that way. Yeah. Okay. So you would have been associated to be a Tory at that point.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's, you're a redcoat, you know?
Sure.
So
yeah.
Like, and even after the revolution is over, it's still like, I mean, if you ever read, you know, Washington, Adams, Jefferson biographies, the first 50 years of this country is trying to combat like Toryism, you
sure
know?
Yeah, yeah,
is
yeah
trying to combat monarchism, you know, mm-hmm, and be a true democracy. So anything that like hints of English monarchy is satanic,
sure,
and has to be
yeah
totally and opposed.
And the fact that Anglicanism is directly linked to the monarch, I can see why it got thrown out.
Right. So this is really important. Of course, people are still familiar with the church that they love. You know, the early Americans were largely Anglican or of the Church of England.
Uh-huh.
George Washington was an Anglican. We've talked about this before.
Uh-huh.
They don't want to totally throw it out, but there's a big question here. It's like, okay, well, what do you do now if you're anti-English, but you're familiar with this church tradition? How do you keep that going?
Sure.
So Samuel Seabury, name that's somewhat helpful to know in American Anglican history. He's also in Hamilton. He has a little role
what
in the musical Hamilton. Farmer Refuted, if anybody's out there listening, there's a little song there. But Samuel Seabury is the first Anglican bishop appointed outside of the British Isles.
Okay.
And but to be ordained, he has to be ordained in Scotland rather than England. So if he's ordained in England, then he has to come under the 1662 prayer book. Sure. He has to minister out of that. Everyone in America is saying, heck no, don't do that. You know? So, but he can still be a minister of some sort of prayer book tradition if he gets ordained in Scotland. So in 1784, Sam of Seabury gets ordained in Aberdeen. I was actually in Aberdeen recently, was able to see some of this history. And this is really, really, really important in understanding how Episcopal identity starts to be developed in America. So not to belabor the point here, but if you know anything about your Scottish history, in the 18th century, Scotland fought pretty fervently against the English from a Catholic standpoint. Mm-hmm. The Presbyterians and Puritans have already left. So largely Scotland opposes the throne, but does so through a more Catholic high church lean.
Okay.
So the Scottish prayer book as well, going back to Charles I, has this more kind of high church, trying to help people understand, but for those who know Laudian, William Laud kind of prayer book style, uh-huh. as opposed to the 1662, which is much more of Elizabeth and of Cranmer.
Sure.
So that's going to shape how the Episcopal Church in North America is well known. So we often say the Episcopal Church is the Anglican version of North American Protestantism, if that makes sense.
Okay.
But in a more specific sense, it's a Scottish prayer book tradition.
Okay. And in that way, it's slightly more Catholic.
Correct.
Okay.
Or slightly more higher church. And this will come to the fore whenever in the 19th century in England, there's what's called the Oxford movement of kind of a higher church lean, guys like John Henry Newman, if you've heard that name. They are looking to things like the Scottish prayer book. They are looking to traditions like the Episcopal Church for some of their developments in their church.
Okay.
So ultimately, this gets really complicated, I recognize, but Seabury did this so he didn't have to take this oath of conformity, this oath of supremacy to the monarch.
Sure.
And as an American, Seabury wasn't able to do this, so it prevented Seabury being consecrated in England. So again, he went to Scotland and was consecrated by the bishops of the Scottish Episcopal Church so he didn't have to take that oath to the British monarch. So.
Great.
Before I get too far, does that make sense, or is that somewhat helpful to kind of understand?
Seabury wants to stay Anglican, but he doesn't want to be English, so he has to go to the Scottish and take and he becomes a bishop under the Scottish, and the reason that it's a little bit different than Anglicanism is because the Scottish are a little bit more high church.
Correct.
Got it.
So 1789 is the first Episcopal prayer book, and I think what you have to understand about the Episcopal tradition and I didn't grow up Episcopal, so I'm much more coming into Anglicanism through North American Anglicanism of the 21st century. But the historic Episcopal prayer book very much so sees itself as an American tradition, is an American identity, contra Tory, going against redcoats, And so it's developing its own tradition with the historic roots that it has as best as it's able. So you've got the 1789 prayer book. It doesn't get revised again until the late 19th century, 1890s or so, 1892. And then you've got, now we're getting into the things that people might be familiar with. The 1958 is the revised prayer book published in America for the Episcopal Church. And then the 1979, it's revised again, published in America. If you grew up in an Episcopal church, you likely used the 1928 or the 1979.
Okay.
Really, the big differences there are... there's not too many, but you may know in the 20th century, there was a lot of what's called ecumenical movements.
Sure.
And what that means is just kind of like, how can we make the church work alongside other traditions as best as possible?
Sure.
How can the Protestant church work with the Catholic church? How can the Catholic church work with the Eastern Orthodox? All these type of things. And how in our liturgies can this be shown? Mm-hmm. Can we pull things from the Eastern Orthodox tradition? Is there a historic medieval prayer that we could maybe add into this here or there just to show the unity in our tradition? So 1928 is a more historical Episcopal prayer book in that sense. 1979 is that more kind of ecumenical flavor and touch to it. So with that, I think you just want to recognize what I just said. As good spirited as it was trying to be, when you start to bring in medieval elements, when you start to bring in ecumenical elements, Eastern prayers, other things, you might be missing some of the original vision, right?
Sure. I mean, yeah, that seems like you're undoing some of what Cranmer was doing in the first place.
Right.
So.
Exactly. So, of course, as you move into the 21st century, that's where you get the split of the Episcopal Church and the Anglican Church, which was largely around worldview issues, you know, but mainly around human identity, sexuality, all sorts of stuff. And primarily around, in the Episcopal Church at least, the election of a bishop who was living in a same-sex relationship. Uh-huh. And so that led to a lot of changes. Of course, don't got to get into all that. But in a few years, by 2009, the Anglican Church in North America was founded. And it being a new province, the prayer book was revised and in 2019 published. So that's where we get our 2019 prayer book from. And I know that was a super simple flyover, but major oversimplifications. But I think just to summarize some of that in some quick bullet points, because the Episcopal Church in North America was founded by a bishop ordained outside of England, it began to distance itself from the 1662 prayer book.
Sure.
And because of that, it began to distance itself from the reformational emphasis of the likes of Cranmer. And so the Episcopal Church and other former British colonies distance themselves from the 1662 if they take a similar route. And so then the revisions that come with the future prayer book in America seek to recover less reformational insights and revise for either modern language or ecumenical purposes. Mm-hmm. So I want to pause right there because I have some things to say about the 2019, but any questions to any of that? Or does that kind of, what are maybe some tensions you're feeling or questions you might anticipate from any of that?
Yeah, let me try and tell it back to you, and you can tell me where I'm not understanding. So, 1662, we've got a prayer book, which you said is kind of like the benchmark. That's the cornerstone prayer book. From there, we've got the American Revolution, and we end up with the Episcopal Church kind of branching off from that. So you've got kind of the American Church branches off in one direction. But then in 2009, we kind of hook back around back in. So in 2009, is that when we become Anglican again?
That's when we start using the language of Anglican.
Okay.
I mean, that's language that's not just decided on by Americans. That's the global church. That's GAFCON. That's African bishops determining that name. Uh-huh. And the name is somewhat indifferent, but if there is any sort of like intentionality to using the language of Anglican, it is to maybe recover that original sense of the doctrine of Anglicanism.
Yeah.
Because you'll see in those prayer books, and I'm not speaking out of turn here, I don't think, but something like the 39 articles in the 1979 prayer book is listed as, it's kind of appended to the prayer book rather than in the 2019 prayer book and in the, go back to 1662, it is part and parcel to the prayer book. In the 2019, at least, it's part of our documentary foundations.
Sure.
It's not just kind of historical addendums to the book. It is a part of what the prayer book is, is the doctrine as well. So.
Okay, so that makes sense. So that is the reason that there's a difference there, though, is
correct,
because you've got that breakaway into, because of the American Revolution, you've got that breakaway theologically from the 1662 that then eventually ends / continues. I mean, there's still an Episcopal Church now, obviously, but there is now an Episcopal Church and an Anglican Church in North America.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think what we're getting at is to understand how Episcopalianism starts, the first 50 years of it or whatever, you really have to understand early American history, and you have to understand like 18th century Scottish history, which the first, I imagine a lot more people know of. The second, I don't imagine people know too much of.
Yes.
But it was interesting. I'll say, just in Scotland, you go into some of these big cathedrals, they will have like American flags up.
Wild.
And they'll have a sign. I saw this in Inverness. It says, this is to mark our long-held communion and affiliation and partnership with the American Episcopal Church dating back to Seabury's consecration.
Interesting.
So I don't ask everybody to do that, but okay. So let me just speak to this. When you open a 2019 prayer book, you'll notice a few things right off the bat.
Uh-huh.
First thing is just it intentionally seeks to recover the emphasis and structure of the 1662 prayer book.
Sure.
Right off the bat. That one of the main declarations of the ACNA, there's seven of them, so this is one of the main ones. It just says, we receive the Book of Common Prayer, as set forth by the Church of England in 1662, together with the ordinal attached to the same, as the standard for Anglican doctrine and discipline, and with the books which preceded it, as the standard for the tradition of Anglican worship. So that first sentence, especially there, is pretty clear. As set forth by the Church of England in 1662.
Sure.
That is difficult to find in those early Episcopal prayer books because of the historical dynamics that are at play.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The preface to the 2019 prayer book states this: "The Book of Common Prayer is indisputably true to Cranmer's originating vision of a form of prayers and praises that is thoroughly biblical, Catholic, in the manner of the early centuries, highly participatory in delivery, peculiarly Anglican and English in its roots, culturally adaptive and missional in a most remarkable way, utterly accessible to the people." Now, I just want to say, people debate that, whether that's not true, whether it is indisputably true to Cranmer's vision, whether it is Catholic, whether it is flexible in certain ways. We don't need to get into all those reasons here. I think what is helpful just to address by those statements is to say that the 2019 prayer book intentionally seeks to recover these emphases. And so this is part of why I'll just say to you, Jake, you know, and listeners while you're listening, part of what makes me like really excited, I think, about where we're at with North American Anglicanism and in the 2019 prayer book is that we're not charting the course ahead and trying to make it up as we go. We're actually trying to say, very similar to what the reformers perhaps were saying, is that perhaps in the last 100-150 years, we've done more to confound and darken,
as our Cranmer would say,
right, than declare and set forth Christ's benefits to us. And actually, we have a chance to recover some of the original vision that made Anglicanism Anglicanism in such a way that it's not that we're like, you know, card-carrying Anglicans because we're the cool, smart people that wear collars and stuff. But no, like, this is like a very gospel-rich tradition that can benefit the church globally. And how we do that is not trying to chart a new course ahead and trying to figure it out for ourselves, but actually recovering the sources that made us who we are in the first place. And I'm not saying there's nothing to be gained from Episcopal theologians, by no means. I think that that would be incorrect to say. I very much so think there have been Orthodox and helpful Episcopal theologians throughout time. And so anyways, this is worth saying. There's still helpful voices out there. But I do think it's just to say, if you can't recognize where that split happens, then you misunderstand how American Anglicanism developed. It's fun at times to meet an Anglican from like South Africa. I'm speaking of somebody maybe here or Australia or another place where the prayer book in Anglicanism made its home. And see like how it's almost like twins separated at birth. You know,
sure,
you meet each other 20 years later and you're like, oh, we do similar things, but we also do very different things.
Sure.
And that's based off of sociology, but it's based off of history a lot too. Mm-hmm. And so that's where that's coming from. And I think for what it's worth, I think we should be very encouraged that the 2019 prayer book does this. It isn't perfect, but I think it does lead us to approach worship in a way that I think somebody like Cranmer and the reformers in their vision of justification by faith desired, which is to declare and set forth Christ's benefits to us. It isn't perfect, which is why we should remind ourselves that Anglicans do not trust in the prayer book as an inspired text.
Mm-hmm. We talked about that in the first episode.
Exactly. Like I said there, you know, in that first episode, sometimes Anglicans call themselves the people of two books. And I think that's not correct. We are people of one book, and I want to be a man defined by one book. But I will say the prayer book, when used well and in step with that original vision, it does a really good job of leading us to that one book, you know? Mm. So anyways, that's all I really had for this episode, I think. I know we talked through a lot of things there, but I think also I hope people recognize, oh, maybe I didn't realize that was the case. And
sure.
I hope you're excited about what the prayer book has to offer moving forward. You know, this exercise is not, you know, this exercise in the whole podcast was not just to give you a history lesson. I think it's really been to bring out the riches of the biblical nature of our prayer book and its theological depth. And within that, I hope you fall more in love with Jesus as you come to an Anglican service, as you come to a service at Holy Trinity. And that you, like Molly Worthen, might not get distracted by things that don't have anything to do with Jesus. In fact, I hope you see Jesus more clearly through our service and that you trust that the 2019 prayer book is able to do that. So this isn't to say that 2019 is the best prayer book of all time or we need to go back to 1552 or 1662. I think it's just helpful for us to understand those original intents and why it's changed, although we've only had to speak of it at brief, but how we lose some of the richness of our liturgies when we aren't aware of some of that history. So anyways, Jake, that's a long-winded way of saying, I hope this has been helpful for
people. Well, I think that's as good a conclusion as I could have done. So I think with that, and to the listener, we'll say thank you for listening with us, and we look forward to seeing you in the next series, whatever that is. Forward to that bonus episode with Ashley Null coming up after this. But other than that, we are done. We hope you've learned a little bit about the prayer book. I know that I have, and I think podcasts are like children. I don't think I'm allowed to have a favorite, but I really like this one. So yeah, it was really, really good. And thank you for all for joining us.
All right. See you.